Margaret, thank you for that really moving meditation. I'm just feeling the power of that, and I'm even hoping it will find its way into other forms. I saw you typed it up, so I'm just dropping that as a little seed. I don't know where it will grow. That's one of the things I love about C3. What is it that we're doing here? Well, we're wandering together, and it's important to open our hearts and ears to a multiplicity of voices and experiences. And so I'm feeling really grateful. So thank you for that. I want to try to talk about what I'm going to refer to as a sacred stance toward the world. I'm just telling you what I'm arguing for right from the beginning. What would it look like to have a posture, what I'd like to call a sacred posture, toward the world and toward the earth community, you could say. And as soon as I say earth community, you might be thinking about mallards and cattails, but I just mean the larger earth community, which is everything that is. You are the earth community. And Margaret was the earth community's voice this morning, speaking of vocation. And just to remind you of what William Stafford said at the end of this poem, your job is to find out what the world is trying to be. Well, how are you going to find out what the world is trying to be? Unless you are in a kind of reciprocal relationship with reality or with the earth or with the earth community. How would you find out? If you had a child and you wondered what this child was trying to be, you would need a relationship with the child to even have the conversation, correct? So I'm saying something as similar is needed, and I'm going to suggest it has something to do with a kind of sacred posture. And I want to try to explore this by, I brought some books today, as you can see. I'm going to read a little bit from Thomas Berry, who is one of my favorite authors, he's very hard to describe exactly what he's up to. He's kind of part theologian, part renegade, part scientist. His background is in history. He's a historian. And kind of like an unusual monk of sorts. Anyway, one of his books is called The Great Work, and he's referring to the time that we find ourselves in. And so I'm going to read some passages from him today that I hope will evoke the sense of sacred stance toward the earth and toward the earth community and toward the way we posture ourselves toward reality. But first I want to make a comment that's going to sound obvious, but, you can decide how it sounds. The universe, apparently, I haven't counted, is 14.5 billion years old. Seems like a long time. My son the other day was watching this YouTube video for science class, and it was like 14.5 billion years across the span of a football field. You ever seen a video like this? You should Google it. Not that I'm in, supporting Big Brother Google. But in any case, it's the length of a football field. And it's funny because at the very end, a foot from the goal line after 100 yards are the dinosaurs, something like that. And then, just inches, millimeters from the goal line is the human species. 14.5 billion years old. What the hell was going on all that time? That's a long time. And even if we take the age of the Earth, which is something like 4.5 billion years old, give or take a half a billion, I suppose, we're at the tail end of whatever it is that has been happening. And even if you think about God as like a creator deity, like in the old world, how many civilizations and cultures thought about God. What was God doing all that time. You know, like, talk about procrastination, you know, if the point is humans. And that's kind of what I'm getting at. Is the point humans? Well, I don't know that. I mean, part of me says no. I mean, but something emerged, which we could call reflexive consciousness, if you want to sound fancy. The universe becoming conscious of the universe. That is part of both the blessing and the curse of being human. We're the earth really becoming conscious of itself. And then we're forced to ask questions like, how do we stand in relationship to the very thing that brought us forth? Now, I want to say something with kind of a wink. You need to believe in a higher power. Okay? Now, I'm not telling you what kind, but think about it for a moment. 14.5 billion years. That's a lot of power and energy moving through the universe. That's a lot of stardust and explosions and gravitational pulls and the warping of time. There's a higher power. In other words, you didn't bring yourself forth. That was the obvious thing I was going to say. You did not bring yourself forth. You are a guest of the dream of the universe. Or the dream of the earth. And all I'm saying is, if we sink into that kind of humility, it helps us have a more sacred posture toward the very things that brought us forth. The energies, the molecules, the atoms, the wildness. I mean, the universe is insane. A virus is wild. Even if you're vaccinated, I've got the vaccine. I don't even know how it works. Magic pills. Like most of you, except maybe one or two that I can think of in here, probably don't have any idea even what a vaccine is. You're like, yes, I do. It's a thing that does things, you know? Okay, what's my point? I don't know what my point is. My point is settling into the humility of how any of us ended up here is important if we're going to think about the future. Because for some insane reason that our ancestors could have never dreamed up, by the way, we now have the capacity to affect even the very foundational structures of the biosphere that we all find ourselves in. We do. With little buttons in hideouts in the Colorado Mountains. That's a reference to nuclear weapons, in case you weren't making the connection. We really have that capacity. No humans ever before us ever had that. And that just goes across the board. In other words, we can alter the very structures of how Earth brought reflexive consciousness forth. And it was kind of a complex sentence. Am I making some sense? All right, so let's listen to some Thomas Berry here. I first would like to read this section. Here's my first point, which is we should get in touch with the wild. We should get in touch with the wild. And this is from an essay called The Wild and the Sacred. And here's a lovely little passage that should all scare us. Okay, here we go. There is an ultimate wildness in all this, for the universe, as existence itself, is a terrifying as well as benign mode of being. It grants us amazing powers over much of its functioning. We must always remember that any arrogance on our part will ultimately be called into account. We would call that karma. Now, we forget that. We think, probably not. Anyway, it won't be. My great-great-grandkids will have to deal with it, you know? The beginning of wisdom in any human activity is a certain reverence for the primordial mystery of existence. This is what I'm calling the sacred stance. The beginning of wisdom in any human activity is a certain reverence before the primordial mystery of existence. For the world about us is a fearsome mode of being. We do not judge the universe. The universe is even now judging us. This judgment we experience in what we refer to as the wild. We have at times thought that we could domesticate the world, for it sometimes appears possible, as in our capacity to evoke the vast energies hidden in the nucleus of a tiny atom. Yet when we invade this deepest, most mysterious dimension of matter, nature throws at us its most deadly forces, wild forces that we cannot deal with, forces that cause us to fear lest we be rendering the planet a barren place for the vast range of living beings. He's saying the universe bites back, and we ought not to forget it. It's teaching us something. And again, the question is, what kind of posture? That's what I'm asking. What kind of stance? What would it look like to have a sacred stance toward even these very energies that we're busy meddling with? Here's another dimension of the wild. I'll set up the quotation by saying this. One of the things that Thomas Berry points out is that the wild has an untamed, uncontrollable vastness and also seems to reflect a disciplined side in the wild itself. In other words, there's chaos and order in all things. It's a yin and yang kind of deal. There's chaos and order, always, and their intention. Just like there's the lack of gravity and there's gravity. And they're pushing and pulling. And he's saying that's part of the wild that we emerged within. And so sort of both poles matter here. Let me read another little section. This is so cool to me. As one woman told a group assembled in Florida after Hurricane Andrew, she did not consider herself a victim, but a participant in this wild event in all its creative as well as destructive aspects. The hurricane, she insisted, was telling us something. It was telling us how to build our houses if we wish to dwell in this region. It was telling us to consider well the winds and the sea, to mark well the fact that if we live here, we must obey the deeper laws of this place, laws that cannot be overridden by any type of human zoning. We might live here if we wish, but on terms dictated by powers other than human. The hurricane has its own inner discipline. It is itself a response to the needs of the region. We need to know how to participate creatively in the wildness of the world about us. How do we participate creatively in the wildness of the world about us? Do you see how infrequently human beings have this stance toward the world? You have to ask the same question about the virus. What is it teaching us about our posture in the world? I don't know the answer. I wish I did. I'd tell it to you right now. I'm just saying it's an important question. It's the same as a hurricane coming ashore. What is it telling us about how to build our house, metaphorically or literally? I don't know. Okay. It is out of the wild depths of the universe and out of our own being that the greater visions may come. I think that's an interesting line. It's like there's a kind of surrender that's needed in what I'm calling a sacred stance that also plants visionary seeds for how to be in the world, how to live in the world, how to live cooperatively in a life-enhancing way, I might say. Okay, that was my point number one. Point number one was we need to get in touch with the wild in all of its vastness, much of which is out of human control. What's our posture toward the wilderness of things? Point number two is this. This, in the opinion of Kent Dobson, which is not really that important, I realize, but the conflict between science and religion has to end in some way. End might not even be the right way of saying it, but the idea that one can be victorious over the other, that's what has to end. They live in creative tension, and that's the way it ought to be. And we ought to enhance the conversation between what I'm loosely calling science and religion. Or I might just put it science and the sacred. They need one another in the 21st century. We can't let the religious posture live in illusions about the way the world really is, what we might call facts. And we can't let science answer questions of value. Why? Because it says we don't answer questions of value. We simply tell you the way things are. Those poles need each other. That's what I'm saying. They must be in conversation. They must be in creative tension. So here's another way of saying it. Facts are not neutral. We used to think they were, but pay attention to all the fights around masks and vaccines and all this kind of stuff. Facts are not neutral. They take us into the realm of values. They force the question. I mean, even if you have different opinions, you're still playing the game of, well, what is more valuable? Where does the value lie? Or let me put it more simply, what do we do with the information that are busy discovering? What do we do with it? Well, we need a value-oriented conversation. You could put it like science and philosophy. Philosophy is the love of wisdom. It's not the love of facts. It's wisdom, which is a value-centered conversation. So we ought to celebrate when these two worlds are talking to one another, and we ought to be participants in that conversation. Something like that. And I want to point out something that Thomas Berry points out now about the era that we find ourselves in, which is different. And I'll set up the quotation. For most of human history, religions, ancient religions, even traditional classical civilizations and indigenous people had a much more cyclical view of the world, meaning seasons come and go, which is true, wouldn't you agree? We're about to enter fall, the summer's been hanging around for a while, and what's going to happen? It's going to get so freaking cold, we're not going to be able to drive on the roads from time to time. That's what's going to happen. And then what's going to happen after that? Then it's going to melt, and we're like, oh my God, we're alive. And then around and around it goes. And this is a fact, and it's deep wisdom. And ancient cultures learned to live in what I would call sacred harmony with the life-death life cycle. Here it comes. That's why there were sacrifices and prayers and around crops and agriculture, and that was their stance in the world. That was their way of relating to the sacred. But something started happening recently to human consciousness because of the dawning of consciousness around evolution. Evolution tells, another story, but I'll just say adds to the complexity of the cycles. It's not just cycles. Every once in a while, there is irreversible transitions. That's all evolution is. Irreversible sometimes cataclysmic transitions. You cannot go back from them. That's not so much in the ancient consciousness, because they were like, well, just turning over. Except every once in a while, a meteor comes and wipes out almost every living thing on the earth. They didn't know about this stuff. And what I'm saying is that human consciousness, right now, our present consciousness, has barely caught up to this earth-shattering realization of irreversible transitions. So I'm going to now read to you. You can see if I did a good job setting the quote up. All right, here we go. After some four centuries of empirical observation and experiment, we are having a new experience of the deepest mysteries of the universe. New experience. We see the universe both as a developmental sequence of irreversible transformations and as an ever-renewing sequence of seasonal cycles. Both, in other words. All right? So it is a way of saying, what can we take from our ancestors and the wisdom and the way they learned to live with the Earth community? And there are irreversible transitions that happen. The sun is going to burn out. Ancient people didn't know that, not really. Do you know what I'm saying? The sun will burn out. That will be it. Lights out for the human species. Even if we go to Mars, the sun's gonna burn out. You know? We could go to Jupiter and be really far. It's still going to burn out. Like, oh, damn, we made it all this way. Still burned out, you know? We find ourselves living both as cosmos and cosmogenesis. I don't want to explain what I think he means by this. In this context, we ourselves have to become something of a cosmic force. If formerly we lived in a thoroughly understood, ever-renewing sequence of seasonal change, we now see ourselves both as the consequence of a long series of irreversible transformations. How do we get here? You didn't plan it. And as a determining force in the present transformation that the Earth is experiencing. And this is the most radical thing that Thomas Berry is saying. What used to be the job of meteors and global viruses and cataclysmic volcanic eruptions, the largest volcano in the United States is Yellowstone National Park. If that baby goes off, lights out for America. But we're a superpower. It doesn't care. All right? That used to be the irreversible transformation and the only kind there ever was up to this point. He's saying in this sentence, now human beings play the same game. You and I and our global industrial economy can cause irreversible transformations in the very cycles of the earth. I'm telling you, what he's saying is very radical, and it's brand new in terms of human consciousness. No wonder people have a hard time with it. They think something like, oh, it won't be that bad, you know. It's like peeing in the ocean, you know. Now, where do we ever get that idea? We got the idea because that's how we evolved. Ever-renewing seasons. It's coming. No one could imagine the world that we're living in now. And we just haven't caught up to it yet. So really, you can ask yourself, in the time I have left on this earth, am I going to be a participant in helping human beings and myself wake up to this new reality, to grow into this new form of consciousness or not? Or we stick our heads in the sand? That's kind of what Thomas Berry is poking around in. And he's saying, I'm now saying, so this is more me, what helps is a sacred stance, a kind of humble stance toward our vast limitations as human beings and our tremendous power right now. It's both. And what increased consciousness can we bring? Here's the final thing I want to add, and I'm done. I want to try to say what I mean by sacred stance in a very simple way, in the form of a question. I think a question that we should be carrying in the 21st century, it's very simple, is this. Will this enhance the well-being of the Earth community, of which I'm a part? It's, in a way, it's kind of a selfish question. When the Earth does well, and I do well. Everyone knows that. It doesn't matter political party. We all know that, really. Let me just ask the question again. Will this enhance the well-being of all? That, to me, is a sacred question. It's a sacred stance. Will this enhance the well-being of all, or of the Earth community, or the place that we call reality? In a life-enhancing way. What are the alternatives? I can think of two. A kind of scary nihilism, which is attractive at times, which is it's just random collision of particles. Everything that we call good, bad, values, it's all an illusion. It's kind of attractive. Maybe you've seen the Big Lebowski. Maybe you haven't. They're nihilists, Donnie. That's for like one of you in this room. It's attractive because just, it's all meaningless. The other alternative is a kind of self-obsessed narcissism, which is, well, I'm going to get all I can, you know? Who cares? It's about me and my rights and my way of life. Neither of those poles are going to help us, and they're not examples of will this enhance the well-being of all. That's the question I want to leave you with. Let me just read William Stafford's line, and then we'll listen to some songs. Just the final line again. Your job is to find out what the world is trying to be. Thanks for listening.